How's everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of the Banker Next Door. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. This is our weekly banking update for April 28th, and I'm coming to you live here from a, well, not live, but pre-recorded, but I'm coming to you from a beautiful day here in Pennsylvania. Definitely our nicest day of the year up to this point. Mid-80s, beautiful sun outside. It was just a great day to be outside. So that's why this video is coming to you a little bit later in the day here than usual, because I was outside having a good time. So, but anyway, lot of stuff happening this weekend. Obviously, we had the Republic Bank failure on Friday afternoon, which made, kind of a bunch of news on Friday night and into Saturday. I just did an episode on that. So you can go and check that out. I just posted that up along with this episode. So if you kind of want the story there on Republic Bank, go check that out. If you need more details on the Republic Bank, go back to episode number 79. Where I basically go through the whole kind of 2-year saga of what was going on there with Republic Bank, if you want a lot more in-depth detail on that. So, and then just a couple other things to note before we kind of get into the numbers here and some of the things I want to hit and talk about this week. So, I posted up two great interviews earlier today. I did an interview with Brian Nestor from Nestor Insurance. Brian is basically a health insurance broker and administrator. And we had a great conversation about getting health insurance for small to medium sized businesses and just all the nuance of that. What are the ins and outs of it? What are things that people should be looking for? So if if you do own a small to medium sized business, and maybe you've got some healthcare or health insurance questions, health benefits questions, definitely worth checking out that interview. The second interview, I'm very, very happy to say, was my very first CEO interview. And I interviewed a gentleman named Robert White, who is the CEO of First Colonial Community Bank here in Pennsylvania. The bank is based and works out of both PA and New Jersey. But Bob was kind enough to come on and do the interview. And we hit on a whole range of topics. We talk about Bob's career, kind of how he got into the CEO job. We talk about the history, the background of First Colonial Bank. And then we kind of wrap up with just getting some general thoughts on the regulatory environment and as well as kind of what he sees with banking the rest of the year, kind of what's going on. What is his take on interest rates, deposits, profit margins, all that good fun stuff. So that was a great interview. So I definitely highly recommend it and hope people will go and check it out. So with that, let's first start off with, so what are some of the economic indicators that we have coming up this week? So on April 30th, we have employment cost index. We get the Chicago PMI and we get the CBE consumer confidence, and that's all coming on Tuesday. On Wednesday, May 1st, we get the ADP non-farm employment change. We get manufacturing PMI. We get the JOLTS job openings. We get the FOMC statement. So that'll be a big thing, seeing, comments from Jeremy Powell. I'm really not expecting any change or anything there. It's basically going to be more of the we're standing holding pat for the moment. Fed interest rate decision, again, holding pat. FOMC press conference. So Wednesday will be a big day. On Thursday, May 2nd, we get the initial jobless claims, we get the trade balance, we get factory orders, and then on Friday, we get the average hourly earnings, non-farm payroll, unemployment rate, services PMI, and then we get the U.S. Baker Hughes total rig count. So some big days coming up. We get basically a lot of employment data this week with, non-farm payrolls and employment rate. We've got all the FOMC stuff happening on Wednesday, along with the JOLTS and the ADP non-farm employment change. So, we're going to get a lot of information there coming up this week. A lot of interesting information that we're going to see coming up, and we're going to talk about some of the economic indicators that we had from last week in just a second, along with, what happened with GDP. But a couple things that I wanted to hit on, just a couple things that came up. There were three things that I saw that were really interesting. So first up was the Supreme Court made a decision that could have a ripple effect on the development of what's called impact fees from townships. So a recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court could have ripple effects on the types of impact fees levied on new developments across the United States. The Supreme Court justices unanimously ruled on April 12th in favor of George Sheets in Sheets versus El Dorado County, in which the petitioner was required to pay a $23,420 county traffic impact fee to build a prefabricated house on a lot he owned in Placerville, California. Sheets paid the fee and successfully obtained the permit, but he also filed a lawsuit over the fee in state court, and the case ultimately made its way to the Supreme Court. Now, Sheets argued that the traffic impact fee imposed to obtain the needed permit constituted an unlawful extraction of money in violation of the Constitution's takings clause, which says private property can't be taken by the government for public use without just compensation. He also argued two previous court cases, that required El Dorado County to make an individualized determination that the fee imposed on him was necessary to offset traffic congestion contributable to his project. The Supreme Court in its decision ruled that nothing in constitutional text, history, or unprecedented supports exempting legislatures from ordinary taking rules. So the case is going now will revert to the California courts to decide whether Sheets will get his $23,000 payment refunded. Those familiar with the real estate industry in the case say the Supreme Court's ruling has wide-ranging implications for impact fees and jurisdictions across the U.S. A lot of developers and builders have been chafing under the increased use of impact fees to fund local government operations. And in California, I think that's understandable, said David Robinson, a law partner at law firm Holland & Knight, noting that in California in particular, the state's Proposition 13 law caps how much property taxes can be raised. Here's the interesting thing about impact fees. Let's take a convenience store gas retailer like a Sheets or Royal Farms or Turkey Hills or a Wawa or a 7-Eleven, like any one of these operators. Okay, they come into a neighborhood, they find a corner lot that makes, you know, fits all their real estate parameters of what they're looking for. Now they go in, they want to buy the lot. Say the lot is, I don't know, $2 million. So they want to go buy this lot. And now they go to the township for approvals. And the township basically comes back to them and says, sure, no problem. We'll grant your approval, but you need to pay $2 million to redo the entire intersection because, you know, the intersection is really going to need all new lighting and, you know, all new lights. And we're going to have to put up all new signage and we're going to need new curbs and new sidewalks. And we're going to have to put a turn lane in over here. And so, you know, the only way that we can make this plausible is for, you know, for you as the developer to pay those fees to redo all that. Now that's great for the township because the township then gets to go back to its residents and say, hey, look, we didn't have to raise any taxes and we got this whole thing redone by the developer. But to the developer, the impact fees, that becomes, in my mind, basically a legal shakedown. Like, in other words, if you don't pay this, you got to pay to play, basically. If you don't pay this, you don't get your permits. Therefore, you can't develop your property. And there you go. So, I think that what has brought this on is that there's a lot of people in the real estate business, a lot of developers who, like it's like the article said, have been chafing at the fact that, you know, hey, man, why, you know, townships keep reaching with the impact fees and like where they can be applied, how they can be applied, how much they can ask for. Any bankers out there that are financing commercial real estate projects of any kind should be paying attention to this. If you work with developers, if you work with home builders, so this could have ripple effects across the U.S. So we'll see. We'll have to see what happens. So a couple other interesting things. The hidden cost of homeownership is mounting and approaching crisis levels. So the cost of homeownership or the cost of home insurance. Insurance marketplace Insurify Inc. projected homeowners insurance would rise about 6% in 2024 after roughly 20% annual rate increases between 2021 and 2023. That would bring the average rate to $2,522 by the end of the year. But states are not seeing equal increases. Florida's rate is expected to go up 7% in 2024 with an average payment of $11,759 a year. Louisiana will see a 23% price hike in 2024 to $7,809 per year. InsureFi attributed the bigger increases in those states to a higher risk of damage from natural disasters and the rising costs of building repairs. Meanwhile, more than a dozen home insurance companies have declared insolvency since 2019 in Florida, according to InsureFi. When insurance companies cannot cover the cost of natural disasters, reinsurance companies, essentially insurance companies for insurance companies, step in at a cost. So that's just really interesting. So again, I mean, obviously all costs are going up right now. When you're thinking about a house, you're talking about, you know, property taxes, all of your utility bills, your insurance, your maintenance, lawn care, the whole jazz, everything's going up. But policy premiums for homeowners insurance have really gone up in the last 4 years. And in certain states, they've gone up big time. So again, just something we have to keep an eye on. This is a huge one. Businesses face systemic shift after the FTC bans non-competes. So the Federal Trade Commission finalized a rule banning non-compete agreements on Tuesday, but that does not mean businesses and managers need to race to toss out their existing employment agreements. That's because the final rule, slated to go into effect in 120 days, will be met with legal challenges. It will take time to play out. Oh, and they were met. They were been sued by, I think everybody under the sun has sued them for this. What employees should do after FTC non-compete ban. So businesses should still take stock of their existing employment agreements and reevaluate the use of non-competes for new hires. That could include using narrowly tailored non-disclosure agreements that do not rise to the level of non-competes, as well as non-solicitation agreements if they are legal in a business owner state. Businesses can also think outside the restrictive covenant box and revisit ways to increase employee loyalty through additional compensation, mentoring, training, and work-life balance. Businesses should reassess non-competes after the FTC ban. Change is already happening at the state level, and there are some exceptions to the FTC's non-compete ban. But here's the thing. The Federal Trade Commission, I think they dramatically overstepped their bound with this ruling. And this is where, I in particular get really annoyed. This is big time, big brother government overreach, and on first class display right here, where the FTC just comes out and just says, hey, you know what? We just decided this week that we don't like, non-compete agreements. So we're just going to ban them. Nobody can have them. That's not their place. It's not their place to do that. It's not their place to make that judgment. That's something that's just left to the labor market. Let the labor market figure that out. This is not something that the FTC needed to get involved with. They didn't need to step into this. They didn't need to make this decision. The reality is there are some places where non-competes are very much needed. You have to have them in place. There's certain industries, there's certain jobs that they have to have this from a competitive standpoint in order to be able to do their job, operate their business, all so on and so forth. We'll have to see. I mean, obviously, again, like I said, they've been sued. There's obviously tons of litigation coming out of this. I will be surprised if this stands up and holds up in court after all the lawsuits and litigation go through. But we'll see. But again, it's big news. That's big news. That's a very big thing. And there are banks across the country that is going to affect in one way, shape, or form. And obviously, thousands of businesses, across the country that's going to affect as well. So, okay. And then the last thing here I just wanted to get into before I hit a bunch of the news items. So Joe Biden this week basically made a proposal to do a couple of new taxes. He wants to basically tax, he wants to increase the capital gains tax, and he wants to propose a new tax on unrealized capital gains. I can't even begin to explain how monumentally terrible those taxes would be, and it's very infuriating because, the government has created this mess with the high inflation, with the out of control spending, And now they need more taxes to cover the bill that they know is coming due. And their answer to this is to tax us further into oblivion. And I'm gonna tell everybody there's a book that I read many years ago by Frederick Bastiat. Was a French economist. He wrote a book in, I think it was 1851, and it's called The Law. And The Law is all a book. That book is just as relevant today as it was written, 170 years ago. And The Law is about what's called legal plunder. It's about all the ways that the government uses taxation to legally plunder the citizenry, and about how you have to watch out for it. You have to push back against it. You cannot allow the government to just, have legal theft and just legally plunder your money. And that's exactly what these taxes are. And this notion that somehow these are just things that are going to affect the rich. I mean, it's absolutely preposterous. You know, I don't care if you own a house that's worth $100,000. You're going to have to pay tax. If you haven't sold it and you owe, you have a $20,000 mortgage on that house, you've got $80,000 in equity. Oh, well, you're now going to have to pay tax on that unrealized gain. If you've got $1 million sitting in a 401k account and you haven't taken that money out, you over the course of the last 20 years, you've accumulated $400,000, $500,000 in gains in that 401k account. Well, guess what? That's unrealized gains. You're going to have to pay taxes on that. I mean, it's just, the whole thing is just absurd on its face. And I hope this just gets blown out of the water. I hope that gets a lot of pushback on this, because these are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, if you want some taxes that will just basically plunder and bury what's left of the middle class in this country, these taxes will do it. The other thing is that, if you want to disenfranchise anybody from trying to even accumulate wealth, from trying to go out there and invest in different types of assets and real estate and businesses and stocks, go ahead and pass these taxes. This will be the death knell to anybody in this country trying to go out and realistically try to build wealth, try to accumulate wealth. And let me tell you something, the rich at the end of the day, your billionaires, they don't care. They don't care. Like this tax, they'll just pay the tax. Okay. And what they'll do is they'll get their army of lawyers and lobbyists to go put in tax loopholes in other areas to make it up for them. That's all. That's all that will happen, because that's what always happens. And it's ridiculous. And and it's just I hope this gets blown out of the water, and I hope it gets pushed back for the absurdity of what it is on its face. So, but anyway, all right, that's my rant. All right, let's get into some news here before we get finished up here for the day. So, okay, what do we got here? Let's go. Okay, so the Commodities Futures Trading Commission is questioning big Wall Street banks, including JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America and Citigroup, over non-disclosure agreements in their swaps and clearing businesses to see whether they gag potential whistleblowers, Bloomberg News reported, citing people familiar with the matter. The CFTC probe expands on similar government investigations on the alleged use of confidentiality agreements to discourage staff or clients from reporting violations, according to the report. Funds in JP Morgan bank accounts in Russia were ordered seized by a Russian court in a lawsuit filed by state-owned bank VTB Bank, Reuters reported, citing court filings. Last week, the largest U.S. bank sued VTB to prevent it from recovering $439 million from a blocked account after Russia invaded Ukraine. Cadence Bank's commercial and industrial portfolio drove an increase in the bank's non-performing loans. The Toledo, Mississippi-based company reported a rise in non-performing assets to $246 million in the first quarter, up from $222 million in the fourth quarter of 2023. Commercial and industrial non-performing loans and leases increased to $155 million from $138 million, while commercial real estate non-performing loans and leases increased to $23 million from $19.3 million. Old National Bancorp reported quarter over quarter and year over year deposit growth despite continued intense competition. Webster Financial Corp plans to reduce its commercial real estate concentration through loan sales, executives said in an earnings conference call. Dime Community Bank shares hopes to bring in up to $400 million in deposits in the fourth quarter with the teams it hired from New York Community Bank Corp earlier this month. Dime was one of three banks to poach several deposit gathering teams from New York Community. former Jane Street Group LLC trader Douglas Schwadewald pilloried his former employer as he denied the company's charges that he and a fellow defector, Daniel Spottiswood, used Jane Street's proprietary strategy and their new jobs at rival Millennium Management. Bloomberg News reported, citing Schadewald's, I'm going to have fun with that name, response to a lawsuit filed by Jane Street this month. The alleged secret strategy involves option trading in India, according to the report. So here's just a little side note. There's a little guy named Sam Bankman-Fried who was a trader at Jane Street before he left to go start FTX. So, yeah, maybe Jane Street's not the most reputable firm out there. We'll put it that way. So, okay. Anyway, so moving on. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is in talks with several firms looking to become central clearinghouses for U.S. treasuries and derivatives trading under the agency's new rule that aims to fortify the world's largest debt market, Bloomberg News reported, citing SEC Trading and Markets Division Director Haoxiang Zhu's remark during a virtual discussion. Okay. Let me move on here. I know there's a couple other big things I wanted to hit here. So, okay. FDIC board member Jonathan McKernan and Chair Martin Grunenberg are working on proposals that would demand asset managers hold more than 10%, asset managers holding more than 10% of a bank's shares to make sure they remain passive investors in such banks, the Financial Times reported, citing McKernan. Asset managers are worried that the proposals would raise compliance costs and make it difficult for investors to take large stakes in banks. According to the report, asset management giant BlackRock, Inc. has 10% or more stake in 38 bank holding companies that are supervised by the Fed or the OCC, but which own FDIC-supervised banks, while Vanguard Group Bank has more than 10% stake in at least one bank that is directly supervised by the FDIC, FT noted. So obviously, yes, this is a huge thing. I have said for a long time that BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard have way too much influence over a lot of companies, a lot of banks in particular, and they should not own more than 10% in these banks. And basically, they should have something that if they can't stop them from owning the stock, they should have some kind of restriction on there that basically makes them a passive investor and does not allow them to simply dictate, what these banks are going to do and how they're going to be run and so on and so forth. So, BlackRock, more BlackRock news. So BlackRock more than tripled its spending to upgrade the home security systems at Chairman and CEO Larry Fink's residence in 2023 after the executive became a target for anti-woke activists and conspiracy theorists. It's kind of funny. Since the launch of the Bank Term Funding Program, the BTFP, in March of 2023, 1,804 depository institutions have tapped the emergency lending facility, of which 1,706, or 95%, were small institutions with total assets below $10 billion, the Federal Reserve disclosed in its semi-annual financial stability report. The BTFP, which was created to help financial institutions cope with liquidity concerns following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, ceased extending new loans on March 11th. So again, yeah, that's a big thing. I didn't think that the Federal Reserve should close the BTFP. I felt like they should have just perhaps extended it for 6 months and just kind of give it a little time, waited to see what happened, and then, and then maybe went from there. So, but I will have the Fed's semi-annual financial stability report. I will be doing an episode on that for next weekend. So keep an eye out for that. Okay. And then I wanted to wrap this part of it up here. I've got some Capital One and Discover Card merger news. If people might remember, I did an episode on that a few weeks back between the, Capital One buying Discover Card. So the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond sent at least two requests for additional information to Capital One for its planned acquisition of Discover Financial Services, questioning how Capital One has prepared for its future size once the deal closes. And the second request for additional information sent on April 12th, the Fed asked Capital One how the deal would impact its current resolution plan and whether it is preparing to comply with the regulatory standards for a Category 2 bank. The Federal Reserve Board extended the public comment period for the application of Capital One Financial Corp to acquire Discover Financial Services through May 31st from April 26th. The office, the OCC, also extended the public comment period for the application of Capital One Unit until 5 p.m. on May 31st from April 22nd. It's standard practice for the Federal Reserve to extend the comment period on bank mergers. We expected the extension, and we don't take any signaling on our deal from the Fed's decision here, said Richard Fairbank, Capital One's founder, chairman, and CEO. Well, that's absolutely true, and that probably is right. However, that is not the tune that they were singing when they signed this deal a couple, maybe about a month or so ago, where they said, "Oh, we're going to get this thing done. It's super, super fast. It, lickety split, and it's all going to go smooth and everything else." Now we get the CFPB director warned of the effects of large deals on competition and financial stability in the credit card industry. While Chopper declined to comment specifically on the deal between Capital One and Discover Financial, he alluded to the transaction, saying it requires some very, very close analysis. So I think that any hope that they had of getting this deal done quickly pretty much went right out the window. And it doesn't seem like the feds are all that, super excited about having this deal in here. So let's look at some other stuff real quick. So Fed's financial stability report highlights key risks. Yeah, I'll talk about that later. FinCEN, $27 billion in elder financial exploitation reported by financial institutions. So you've got a lot of elder fraud going on out there. ICBA meets with the CFPB on 1033 concerns. That is open banking. And so during the meeting, they encouraged the CFPB not to require banks to provide tokenized account numbers in lieu of routing and account numbers, which would be too complex to require as part of the rulemaking. That's very interesting. They want banks to provide tokenized account numbers. Why would you want banks to provide tokenized account numbers? I can't understand, man. Maybe a central bank digital currency, maybe something there. They also expressed concern that community banks will be dependent on their core processors to create compliance software. Yes, they will. Said the data security practices of third-party data recipients remain a serious concern, and the Bureau should actively supervise third parties to ensure adequate safeguards of customers' personal financial information. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If you want more information on that, go and see my episode on open banking. Okay, Labor Department finalizes opposed overtime rule. The Labor Department issued a final rule to increase the number of employees who are totaled to overtime compensation. The G7 conducts a cross-border cyber exercise. Treasury announced that the G7 Cyber Expert Group last week completed a cross-border cybersecurity coordination exercise. The exercise was designed to strengthen the ability of G7 financial authorities to coordinate responses in the event of a significant cross-border cyber incident affecting the financial sector. The exercise assumed a large-scale cyber attack on financial market infrastructures and entities in all G7 jurisdictions. That's very interesting. I find the timing of that very interesting, but we'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that. So new home sales rise in March. Sales of new home sales increased 8.8% in March and were up 8.3% from a year ago. The median sale price was $430,000, up from $406,000 in February. We already talked about that. DOJ targets founders of major crypto mixer. The Justice Department charged the heads of a major crypto mixer with conspiracy to commit money laundering and operating an unlicensed money transmitting business. So I think this was more... this was called Samurai Wallet. Malicious actors used crypto mixers such as Samurai Wallet and Tornado Cash to launder stolen digital assets. So interesting. That could be another crypto series episode. Durable good orders grow in March. The Commerce reported that new orders for manufacturing durable goods increased 2.6% in March. GDP rises 1.6% in quarter one advance estimate. The gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 1.6% in the first quarter, following a 3.4% increase the previous quarter. The increase primarily reflects increases in consumer spending, residential fixed investment, non-residential fixed investment, and state and local government spending, which were partly offset by a decrease in private inventory investment. So I have a whole lot. I mean, obviously that is a collapse. They try to spin this as like, it's a good number that we got a 1.6% increase in GDP. That's not a good thing. That's a bad thing. GDP basically collapsed. And the only reason it was positive was because of all the government spending. They're putting out a ridiculous amount of government spending to buy growth. And if you take that out of the equation, you're left with negative growth. And, you know, and I've been saying that for a while now, that the GDP is just ridiculous. And I might even add the GDP to when I do the updated jobs episode, which I'll hopefully have coming out next weekend. So, okay, I have a lot more stuff here, but just don't have quite enough time here to get to all of this right now. So I'm basically going to wrap up the episode. So I hope everybody enjoyed another action-packed episode here this week. A lot continues to happen in the banking industry. There's just all kinds of stuff happening at the moment. I do have to apologize. I was not able to put the finishing touches this week on the next couple of episodes of the Lords of Easy Money, but those will be, look for those during the week this week. I will be doing basically episodes 11 and 12 will be coming out, which is chapters 9 and 10. So I will have those two coming out this week. And then I'm hoping, because I think there are 18. There's 18 chapters in the book. So I'm hoping to get through the last, you know, 7 chapters fairly quickly. I'm hoping to be able to kind of plunge into that and maybe do two of those a week for the next like 3 weeks or so, and just kind of get that out there and get that series finalized there, just so we can kind of get to the end a little bit quicker. So keep an eye out for the Lords of Easy Money episodes during the week this week. And then next weekend, I'm going to come back. I've got about 6 or 7 episodes slated to come out next weekend for a range of topics that I'm working on that I haven't been able to get to here for the last week or so, but a lot of stuff that's got to be reviewed and that I got to get to. So, okay, we'll keep an eye on that. And like I said, if you didn't get a chance to check out those two interviews with Brian Nestor and Bob White, the CEO of First Colonial Bank, please go on and check those out. That would really, really help and would really make me happy if a lot of people viewed those episodes. So, but until later in the week, I hope everybody enjoys the rest of the weekend. If you haven't gotten outside, get out there yet. I hope it's nice wherever you're at. And like I said, I will see everybody again next weekend. And please make sure to check us out on YouTube, Rumble, and all major podcast platforms. And as always, if you like this episode, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe, and leave your comments. That always helps out the channel. And I will see everybody again real soon.